We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, no Maria this week. She'll probably be out for the next several weeks due to the demands of her work. So,
yes.
Very busy person this time of year.
Day jobs are so unfortunate.
Yeah. We should all be so unlucky.
As our rents, you know.
Yes. So.
Okay, all right. Let's go.
Let's go. Let's start with concrete strike.
Yes, the concrete workers, the drivers for that essential but unsung construction job, have been on strike since December. It's a local of the local Teamsters, and it came out this week that one of the reasons that major developers in the region haven't particularly been in a hurry to settle that strike is that they've been hiring something called ghost drivers, which is a fancy term for scab. Those scabs have been working, including at several public sites. Sound Transit has been utilizing them. And so, the concrete worker strike is becoming less effective because developers are hiring these non-union drivers to cross the picket line. So the more we can do to talk up that strike and raise awareness that this is going on and that people should not cross picket lines because it's bad form, among other things, the better. So that strike continues. It is, like I said, in its third month, and hopefully they can find some sort of resolution soon.
I wonder if our council member, Shama Sawant, is aware of the strikes, and she has been very upfront about other strikes, Starbucks. And
yeah, she has, and she's been supportive of the Teamsters in this strike as well. I'm sure people in her office know about it, but couldn't hurt to pass along a note.
All right. So next item I saw in Crosscut this week on the 9th, they produced an article about Climate Pledge Arena. The management group there, Oakview, made a decision that that this Seattle King County Health Clinic, which is a yearly event that you and I have seen when we used to do the show at Seattle Center at KAXP, would see once a year the large crowds of people that come in, thousands of people that line up for days, sometimes days ahead of time, for free health care.
Yes.
Literally
thousands of people attend that.
Yeah. People in dire need, within our wonderful health care system that we have in the United States.
And there's a similar event at a different time of year, I believe, for free dental care, which is even worse since most insurance policies don't cover dental for reasons. They also don't cover eyesight or hearing.
Yeah.
Things that mean as though those are not part of the body and part of healthcare, but go figure.
Yeah. Yeah. Only in the U.S. would
this
happen. So anyway, long story short, this had been a yearly event. They'd been waiting, a couple of years during the pandemic to, the health clinic to get back in and
do it. Irony of ironies. Yeah.
Yeah. And the, Oakview management group there, initially was cooperating for dates in October, and then they did a 180 and basically went, oh, we're going to book in, a couple bands instead and, see you later.
For the basketball arena, yeah.
So, Climate Pledge Arena.
One of which was the Who, and, that ticket is probably at least a couple $100. So that pays a lot more money than poor people for the free clinic.
Yeah. Well, my understanding was that was a used to be a city-owned facility, and it's just another sad sign of where things are heading.
It still is. It's just that Oakview contracts with the city to manage it, but presumably, you know, the city has some oversight of that. So might be something again to talk to city council about.
Yeah. As well as, you know, if any of our listeners happen to have connections with the Who or the Zac Brown Band, you know, I'm betting they weren't told ahead of time that they'd be bumping.
I'm real tight with Roger Daltrey, so sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you're both about the same age.
Yeah. Don't remind me.
All right. So also this week, there was, it appears that Mayor Bruce Harrell is continues to ramp up the sweeps, City Hall.
Yeah, and the howling monkeys on the city's small but vocal far-right anti-homeless lobby are really thrilled about it. There were several sweeps in the neighborhood of City Hall this week, presumably because, you know, that's what Harrell sees on his way into work. Although they have underground parking, so he wouldn't even see it. But maybe he has staff people who tell him about it. And it really epitomizes, and goodness knows we've talked about this on this program before, the failed policies of the city where you just push them out of one area and push them into another. That doesn't solve anything. It just makes life more miserable for the homeless. You know, as though they're not miserable enough already, because anybody who's actually lived on the street overnight or had to stay overnight on the street would have some understanding and empathy for that kind of situation. But with the pandemic, we have record numbers of homeless who are living, you know, outdoors. And I don't see a whole lot of solutions coming from City Hall. I just see, you know, this kind of reactionary BS.
Yes. All right. So also this week, the Seattle Police Commission held its third community engagement meeting with the Federal Monitor on on Tuesday. That was, as two different people that attended it live, one called it a, I'll use a different word here, a poop show.
Yeah.
And the other said it was actually very good for what it ended up revealing. So,
which is kind of damning with faint praise, but I get the point.
Yeah. So, just like the previous two meetings, the public was invited to attend the meeting. This one was on, use of force. Apparently they were saving the best to last, but, people got really frustrated after they realized, after the meeting started, and they realized that the public was not going to be allowed to actually ask questions using, you know, their microphones. They were relegated to using the chat feature on Zoom, which is
a way of keeping it really antiseptic.
Mm-hmm. Particularly
for an emotional topic like use of force.
Exactly. So they quickly became an unhappy crowd, and about just a little less than halfway through the meeting was 2 hours, the CPC, who was just hosting the meeting, they weren't really the speakers there per se, decided to open it up to people so that they could actually speak. And I just happened to have 7.5 minutes of some of the content edited from that, if it'd be okay to share that with you.
Yeah, let's do it. People should hear this.
Okay, so just 1 second. Here we go.
Matt and Brian, just so we're making sure that we're giving folks the opportunity to ask their own questions and making sure that they're really clear, there's been a lot of commentary in the chat about being able to have an actual dialogue with you all. So we're gonna work to get folks to re-raise their hands so they can ask any questions that have not been pointed out already to the both of you, okay? Dr. Gill, you should be able to unmute yourself.
Yeah, I think I am. There's a whole list of questions we haven't gone over, but Mr. Maxey, I again will challenge you. I have gone through the SBD publicly available data set, four times. I've captured snapshots and downloaded it. So I don't know if it's been changed in the last few days, but certainly as of 2-3 weeks ago, the 6.5 year period covered for the crisis context is missing the 9 people in behavioral crisis that were killed by the SBB. That is just simply a fact. If we're talking past each other and you're talking about a different data set, then that should be made clear. But I'm going to repeat it again. The data set available right now does not have those people who were murdered.
I hear you. That's not my understanding, but I will have that pre-audited and double check it.
And actually, if I could just, this isn't complex. I just put the names in the chat, and let me tell you my procedure. It wasn't, you know, this didn't require Sherlock Holmes. What I looked for was any use of force, any type 3 use of force, either on the day of or even as late as the day after, that would correspond with a death. That would correspond with any of the demographic information, male, female, and it's simply absent and missing. And I even allowed for the fact that maybe it happened late at night, maybe the report got rolled over, it was a day late, whatever. And in all 9 of those cases, I put them in the chat, and I will say 8 of those are unquestionably severe behavioral crisis. It doesn't take a complex definition. They were almost all 911 calls where someone said someone was acting crazy. In one of the cases, I would give you grant that there's some question. I think it was a behavioral crisis, but anyway, I think I made the point. The 9 names are in there. I sent them to Ofteli on January 24th, and there has still been no response. So,
Castile, I'm going to bring you in so you can speak. I see your hand is raised.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I might be a little off subject, but I feel disrespected. This is absolutely having to do with people impacted by the police, whether that be by murder, killings, or harm. This is not something that is passing each other. This is not something where we need to be pitting the disabled community, who also people who have mental health issues can be considered disabled, who have been killed and murdered by the police. You know, this absolutely is an issue that has to do with impacted folks and impacted families. We should absolutely have a voice in this. And I absolutely feel 100% disrespected, as anyone in my position would, to be told something like that when I'm coming to a meeting that's supposed to be talking about accountability and the dissent decree, because of the abuses that we have suffered under by the Seattle Police Department. So please, if you are going to address us, if you're going to address us as a community, please have a little bit more respect in regards to that. And don't dismiss us based on your own experiences that you do not share with me. So whomever has that attitude, please show a little more respect to impacted families and impacted family members, because we should be having a voice on this. We should be on this committee. Absolutely. Because if anybody's impacted, it's people who are 6 feet, 9 feet under the ground right now, who don't have loved ones, who can't see tomorrow. Absolutely. Please, please try to pit that against you being able to get up every single day and breathe every day. I'm done.
I see Queenie, so I am going to unmute you. Hold on one sec. Okay, you should be good to go.
Hello. I've been to a couple of meetings, and I was informed that it's a strange word to see data. These are human beings. And I used to be a human being, I guess. Now it's not being human. But I've been affected like the full circle. My cousin was killed by the San Diego police. I have 5 friends that was killed by the SPD. Then I go and educate myself, the person that is against me, and educate myself with the Police Academy, the Community Academy. to learn what are they doing. And then I hear the mediator saying data and levels, one, two, threes. It affected me hard because I know the person they're calling. I have a friend that gets those calls when somebody is upset or outraged or not doing well. But I don't know what kind of program, because I don't think he's in my county, but I want to understand the steps that the county takes when the police come in and somebody's being outraged. What are the steps they take? Those like, oh, there's one, two, and three in pain. I don't get the pain. Because I still, Miss Ely, I still live with her son dying, being pulled out of the ambulance and being choked to death. And I fight for advocacy for any and everything. But this affects me because I have a young black male that I'm going to always advocate for and the people and my community. But when I hear not like formats or anything that says, this is what we do, this is how we do it. And they have committees that come quarterly. How is it that we have committees that get together quarterly when we still haven't got a format put together, when they should be meeting monthly and getting something done and saying, hey, let's take these steps? Can somebody please explain something? That's it.
So that was some edited audio from this last Tuesday's Seattle Community Police Commission public
hearing. I do not understand. You know, when you have a topic that is as emotional as law enforcement on duty use of force, and you have people in the community who have been directly affected by this, why you would relegate them to chat input for an oversight committee? You know, they need to be hearing from, and as one of the speakers said, they need to have people on that committee who have been impacted by police violence. Goodness knows there's enough of a pool of people in our community who have been impacted that way that you should be able to find somebody qualified who can do it. We've talked a lot on this show about the relative failure of the different law enforcement oversight bodies. There are three of them. And the CPC was formed out of the reform process 10 years ago, specifically because of the failure of the other two. So this is sort of the committee of last resort for people in the general public who have something to say on this topic. And, you know, they had plenty of time to plan for this. I don't understand why they set it up in such an exclusionary fashion. I'm glad that they finally allowed people to testify with audio, even though necessarily it had to be over Zoom. But, you know, I don't understand the failure of planning.
Yeah.
That's about all I can say on that.
All right.
I hope that's not a reflection overall of how either well organized or poorly organized the CPC's operations are, because that was a fail right there.
Yeah. And as I've said before, I don't think I've specifically mentioned Howard Gale's name, but he's
been doing this for decades.
Yeah, he is.
He's a bulldog.
Yes, and between him and Carolyn Bick writing at the South Seattle Emerald, either of those are stronger mechanisms for transparency in Seattle for police accountability issues than the current oversight bodies appear to be. So,
and Howard is doing this on his own time with publicly available data, as you heard.
Yep.
You know, why the CPC wouldn't have somebody either on the commission, or I don't know if they actually have a paid staff. I would hope so.
I think they do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, how difficult can this be to ferret out for somebody whose job it is to ferret it out? I don't know.
Well, he does appear to get pushback from time to time from those same bodies, as as does Carolyn Beck, just trying to get responses from the mayor's office and different entities. It's a struggle for her.
Oh, I can. Thank and not just the mayor's office, but I mean, it's notoriously difficult to get SPD to cooperate with Freedom of Information Act requests. You know, I mean, with the different administrations, it goes up and down, but usually it's been pretty difficult. Their communications department, tends to sit on information for a really long time. And that's been true for decades, really. I don't think it's changed, and I'm sure that people like Carolyn or Erica Barnett at Public Cola or some of those folks who make frequent use of FOIA requests, I'm sure they get to run around all the time. It's one of the big challenges.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on.
Sure.
How about developments this week with the COVID pandemic?
Well, there's quite a bit. As of midnight, Friday night, the state mandate for masks ended. There actually are no remaining states that have indoor mask mandates, which strikes me as incredibly premature, number one, because even though infection rates are dropping, they're still quite a bit higher than they were at the height of Delta. And, you know, the new infection rate is declining, but it's declining relatively slowly. Over the last 7 days, King County averaged 220 new cases per day. That is below the Delta peak, finally. And it's certainly down from the peak of about 6,600 in January. So it's dropped a lot over the past 6 or 7 weeks.
Is that for the state or King County? Or
that's for King County. That's
okay.
Not for the state.
The
peak for the state was like 19,000, also in mid-January. So, yeah. But again, Delta's peak for King County was about, I think about 400 a day, new cases. About July. So it's still relatively high. And we're seeing this around the country, but also around the state. It is dropping all across the state at this point, which is good. There are a lot of countries where Omicron is still playing havoc with their healthcare systems, and I'll get to that in a minute. We don't know about new variants that might come along. Maybe this is the end of the pandemic, but we've heard this before, right? And then a new variant comes along and we have to reinstitute mandates all over again.
Yeah.
But that indoor mask mandate ended at midnight last night, so you should be able to go into your favorite bar or restaurant without a mask. And, I would still, number one, make sure you're vaccinated. And get a booster if you can, because Omicron in particular does not respond to the initial two-shot vaccine. It does respond very well to the booster, which is to say the booster prevents new infections for Omicron much more effectively than the first two shots do. So get a booster if you haven't gotten it. And remember, there are a lot of people, including the immunosuppressed, including people small kids who are not eligible for are not eligible for vaccines at all. Who can still spread the disease and who are still susceptible to your spreading the disease. So wearing a mask prevents that. It prevents you from getting disease, but more importantly, it prevents you from spreading it to other people. So I would still be cautious, but that's just me. But the mask mandates for the state are now history, so we'll see how it goes. We're going to have a real-time experiment on how well this works, and I have to keep a very close eye on new infections over the next couple, 3 weeks.
Well,
how that goes.
Both you and your partner are immunocompromised, isn't that true?
Yeah, so, you know, we've been self-isolating for over 2 years, which, you know, to be honest, it has sucked. But we've also managed to avoid getting infected. And, you know, we're boosted. And again, the problem with immunocompromised people and immunosuppressed people is that the vaccine is not effective because your body doesn't produce antibodies,
right,
the way a normal body does. So, please be cautious. We're still going to be cautious for the foreseeable future, unfortunately. And then we'll see how it plays out, and hopefully the infection rates will keep going down, because certainly everybody's, you know, tired of the pandemic. Somebody's got to do a comprehensive history of this, because you may not remember this, but we're closing in on 1 million people having died from COVID-19 just in the United States. Just in the last 2 years, we just passed the 2-year anniversary of the first known death. So, when the history is written, and hopefully it will be, there's plenty of blame to go around, and we'll talk about some of the major actors in that in a little bit here.
Okay.
And then I should also mention that there was a major development in Congress this week. While we're talking about national pandemic news, on Wednesday, Democrats pulled out $15.6 billion in emergency pandemic aid from a broader spending bill that was meant to keep the government from shutting down, which seems to be about the only time that Congress can take action on anything. But Republicans were objecting to how the money was going to be found to pay for that. So Democrats pulled it out because, of course, there was a deadline, as there usually is on these things. $15.5 billion that won't be spent to help people who desperately need it, because of long COVID, because of long-term unemployment from illness, from healthcare costs, you name it. This was meant to help states and localities cover the costs associated with the pandemic. And, that's gone now. Because again, the Republican death cult, felt it more important to take a principled stand for whatever their principles are. Mostly obstructionism, I think. But, yeah.
So money. But they did find money for different war efforts around the world, all the usual stuff, just not for anything for those people that are ill and or individuals that are being evicted, or, you know, the small businesses that went.
Yeah, they did eventually restore funding, but what they did is they pulled it from existing pandemic emergency responses. For instance, they transferred $7 billion that states were supposed to get for their pandemic response. So it was kind of a robbing Peter to pay Paul kind of thing. The new money evaporated. So, yes. And the Biden administration is, you're right, still spending money overseas, which is important because that's where the variants, new variants are likely to show up. And there are still several parts of the world where Omicron is riding high, and particularly countries that have had previously had pretty effective pandemic responses. New Zealand has one of the highest per capita infection rates in the world right now. South Korea also got a lot of praise for their very aggressive early response to the pandemic, but they're now you know, setting daily records for new infection cases. Vietnam went the first year of the pandemic without any deaths at all from COVID-19. And that now has one of the highest infection rates in the world. And aside from Asian and Oceania countries, you're also seeing infections in South Pacific Island countries that managed to get through the entire pandemic without having any cases because they were isolated. And they're now getting a lot of community transmission. But you've also got this war you may have heard of in Ukraine, which is creating a massive refugee crisis in Eastern Europe. And that almost certainly is going to drive up infections also. These are things that, you know, eventually are going to affect the United States because, you know, when you have extremely high infection rates, that's what makes it more likely that new variants will get created that will become a problem down the road. So we'll see. But yeah, the pandemic is certainly not over at a global level. And we also mark our 6 millionth death worldwide from COVID-19 this past week, which is an almost unfathomable, you know, it's basically the population of Metro Chicago, which is saying a lot.
All right. Well, moving on, the census, 2020 census.
Yes. The 2020 census, according to, the Census Bureau, the overall count of the 2020 census, they say is accurate because, of course, they adjust it and use statistical analysis to figure out what the actual count probably is. But they say it's severely undercounted the number of Hispanic, Black, and Native American residents. So that's the Census Bureau saying that. So, and, you know, I've heard from people who worked in the Seattle area, census count, who say that they're fairly confident that Seattle was accurate, but, Yakima Valley, maybe not so much, et cetera. So what the impact of this, of course, and this is something that the Trump administration, was supposedly blocked in court from doing, that they were trying to undercount non-white U.S. residents because they tend to vote Democratic, and the census, the every 10-year census is used to do redistricting for Congress and for state legislatures. And, of course, we're seeing that in the gerrymandering that's flowed from that in different state legislatures around the country. And while Washington's redistricting process was flawed, and we've talked about that in past weeks, it's you know, relatively unbiased. The whole point of trying to suppress non-white count in the census is to try and undercut you know, Democratic representation for those communities. And the Trump administration was all about trying to do that. And it looks like they were successful. So while the Census Bureau reported that that undercount had taken place, they didn't talk about what kind of remedial steps might be taken to try and address that. You've got a lot of experts who follow this kind of thing saying maybe it's time to ditch the every 10-year census and just do continuous counting based on, you know, other, government databases that already exist. And the Census Bureau does track that already. They come out with yearly estimates for the populations and demographics and all the rest of that. So, you know, unfortunately the redistricting process, that the census is, that rely on the census for their raw numbers, that has already taken place in most states. So it may be too late to undo that, and that has huge political implications for the next 10 years.
Okay. Well,
good news, good news, good news.
That's what we deliver every week.
Yep.
All right. Well, continuing with the good news. So, Tina Peters, who the heck is Tina Peters?
Tina Peters is the election official in Western Colorado, Mesa County, Colorado, who became a hero on the far right for basically getting arrested for tampering with voting machines. Now, you may think that this is the sort of thing that the far right would be all over for a different reason, because, you know, vote fraud. But Peters was an active Trump believer who, bought into the conspiracy theory that I'm not going to try and summarize it, but it had to do with Dominion voting machines and Hugo Chavez and God knows what else. She took the data from voting machines in Mesa County and posted them on the right-wing website so people could look over it themselves for evidence of vote fraud. Well, you can't do that. That's tampering with voting machines. That's a felony. And she was indicted by a grand jury this week for having done that. Now, some of the self-styled audits that you've seen, most notoriously the one in Arizona that went on for months and months, that has caused the jurisdictions that had those voting machines to have to spend millions of dollars to get new voting machines, because once they're broken into in that way, they can't be used again. So there's a real cost to taxpayers here too. And of course, you know, it's trafficking and the kind of baseless conspiracy theories that are still like driving Donald Trump and his supporters and the big lie and all the rest of that January 6th. And we're going to be hearing a lot more about that in coming months. But it was nice to see, because there were several incidents around the country, Pennsylvania, Michigan, where people were doing these sort of vigilante audits of the 2020 votes, only for president. They didn't, these tend to happen in Republican areas, and oddly enough, the Republican Congress people never questioned their own reelection, just the votes for president. So go figure. But it is nice to see that there is some legal accountability for at least one of these incidents.
All right. Since we're on the subject of grand juries, I understand there was also one in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes. People may remember the case of Makia Bryant. She was a 16-year-old black girl in foster care in Columbus, Ohio, who was shot and killed by a Columbus police officer last year. She was in the front yard, and this was like her fifth foster home in 2 months or something insane like that. The officer said she was wielding a knife. She was in an argument with another resident of the foster home.
Oh, I do remember that.
The officer who shot and killed her, a guy named Nicholas Reardon, a grand jury had been convened to decide whether to press charges against him for her death. And that grand jury came back yesterday and, no charges. So this just underscores again how in many of these cases, and you never even heard about this before, the George Floyd killing and all the protests that followed that, it's still much less common, than not to have these officers charged in these kind of cases. It still requires, in this case, you probably had a prosecutor who didn't want to press charges. And that's one of the flaws of the grand jury system, is deliberations are secret. And so there's no accountability for what the prosecutor actually gives to the grand jury, either in terms of exculpatory evidence for a criminal defendant, or in this case, evidence that that might lead to charges. If somebody doesn't want it to have someone prosecuted, they can almost certainly arrange a grand jury outcome in that direction. And same for if they do want somebody prosecuted. And the problem with this particular system is there's an inherent bias because prosecutors work with law enforcement every day. And they are almost always consciously or unconsciously biased in favor of being sympathetic to law enforcement. And that is one of the many hurdles to having an on-duty killing prosecutor, which leads to the kind of, poop show that we had with the CPC meeting this week in Seattle. And the many, many questionable use of force cases SPD has encountered over the years, and King County Sheriff's Office as well. So that particular case in Columbus, Ohio, not going to be prosecuted.
All right. On to, let's leap over to Texas, where there were some court rulings this week.
Yeah, we're still in the right-wing fever swamp. The anti-abortion law that has gotten so much attention in Texas, which basically outlaws abortion after 6 weeks, survived its last court challenge this week when the Texas State Supreme Court threw out a lawsuit challenging the enforcement mechanism. You'll remember that, the state will pay a bounty to any private citizen who turns in somebody who got an abortion somewhere. That the challenge to that mechanism was thrown out for lack of standing. And so, that law is going to be on the books for the foreseeable future. Another court in Texas, a piece of good news, throughout the executive order from Governor Greg Abbott last month that asked state agencies to investigate for child abuse the parents of any transgender kid who get medically appropriate seek out medically appropriate treatment for gender dysphoria or other treatment for somebody trying to transition. That was challenged by parents of a 16-year-old girl who is transgender. And that was thrown out by the court, saying that it was unconstitutional under the Texas Constitution, that was something only the legislature could do. And I'm sure the legislature will be rushed into special session now to pass a law. But Abbott overstepped his authority. And, the girl in question is very articulate. She's been speaking to the media also and saying, look, I don't appreciate being a pawn so the governor can score points with his base. Which is basically what it was about. And, there's real cost to real people and real families with these kind of laws. We saw also Idaho trying to pass a similar law. The state house in Idaho approved legislation this week that will make it a felony for a doctor to provide age-appropriate, medically necessary, best-practice gender-affirming care for transgender kids. So that bill, it's H. Bill 675, now heads to the Idaho Senate for further consideration. And again, this is born out of ignorance. It's born out of anti-science, and it's most of all, it's born out of bigotry, and it's really unfortunate for the kids and the families involved.
Ah, wow. All right. Well, I think that then moves us on to international.
And yeah, nothing going on in international news this week, huh?
Pretty slow week. Unfortunately not. It's not been a slow week.
Okay, well, I will try to summarize, and we've had 45 minutes of non-Ukraine news. Aren't you glad? Because the Ukraine really has been crowding almost everything else out of the news this week. So a lot of important things did happen in the Russian invasion this week. Let's talk first of all about nuclear power and the problems with the nuclear power, specifically the Chernobyl exclusion zone and the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is the largest in Europe. Power to both of those facilities has been cut off by the Russians occupying those facilities now. and the people in charge of maintaining those plants have not been allowed in or out since the Russians took those plants over. The Russians, in fact, are using Zaporozhye as a base of operations for military in that region. So this is raising concerns about, well, what happens when the auxiliary power, the generators that are used to, you know, power the cooling rods and all the rest of that, when it's off the grid, what happens when those generators run out of fuel? So far, the IAEA has been saying, oh, nothing to worry about here. They can go for a month or two. The war is likely to continue to go on in a month or two. But, the fact is that nobody has any idea what's going on within those plants right now, whereas usually they are routinely monitored by an international monitoring organization. So keep an eye on those, both, either one of which could go sideways in a very bad way.
Yeah. I know of multiple people who are experts in the nuclear power issues. And, for instance, I believe it was Bob Alvarez was talking about, so they've got these rods that are being kept in pools, literally in pools of water.
Yes.
And it requires a circulatory system to take the water out, clean it, and then it pumps it back in, as well as the air that is within the room itself is also circulated to keep the temperature down. So when the power gets cut off for extended periods of time, and it's an issue that affects nuclear reactors everywhere. When the power gets cut off, then the water begins to heat up, and at some point it evaporates, and then you've got a situation where these rods can begin to melt down and become critical. And he was doing calculations based on previous information that had come out about the situation, and he basically came up with that it could just be within a matter of days, like 2 days after everything's been cut off, that you could start to see significant evaporation I think the International Atomic Energy Commission is really downplaying the criticality of this situation.
That was the sense that I had as well, and I'm not sure why, and I'm not sure on what basis they're downplaying it, but it seems to me that's something that could become very bad very quickly, like within a few days.
And again, this is something that affects all the nuclear reactors, certainly in the United States as well. Everybody assumes, well, it's a nuclear power plant, you know, it can just power itself. But if you get into situations like this, they can't. They require outside power, sometimes from local generators and stuff, to keep them safely running. That's, you know, one of the ironies of this choice of energy production. So
And as we saw with Chernobyl, with Fukushima a few years back, this affects everybody in the Northern Hemisphere, because eventually it goes all the way around the world. Mm-hmm. When you have those kind of radiation releases, I forget the estimated death toll from cancers as a result of the 1986 Chernobyl release, which remains the worst in world history, is something insane. It's dwarfed by the pandemic now, but it's still, you know, tens and tens of thousands of people, which is,
yeah, know. I think it was vague memory that it was definitely six figures, so 100,000.
Yeah. So it's still an awful lot of people. You've got not one, but two plants that we know are a problem, or a potential problem, I should say, in Ukraine right now. Ukraine total has 15 different nuclear power plants, 13 of which are still in Ukrainian hands. So, we will have to keep an eye on all of that. That, in terms of how it affects the world, was probably the biggest story this week. It didn't get a lot of attention. But, like I say, pay attention to it going forward. We are, of course, people are complaining about gas prices now, which, you know, the more we can do to get away from fossil fuels, the better. Biden did announce this week he would boycott purchases of Russian oil and gas. And more significantly, he convinced European allies to do the same. Russia only supplies about 10% of the oil and gas in the United States, but it's about a third in Europe. So the European boycott is actually much more significant in terms of both Europe having to replace that with other energy sources and in terms of its financial impact on Russia. You know, the Russian economy is becoming increasingly isolated. We saw a number of huge transnational corporations pulling out of Russia this week, including on the same day McDonald's, Coke, and Pepsi, which, you know, probably did more for Russian health than anything else. It's looking like Russia is settling down for the long haul. They're laying siege to major Ukrainian cities, and you know we're seeing just horrific stories out of cities like Mariupol in southeastern Ukraine, where a children's hospital and maternity ward was bombed this week. That got a lot of attention. But it seems like right now it is the Russian strategy to encircle cities, try and prevent anybody from getting in or out, and then not just starving people out, which bear in mind, you know, there's a significant history of this in Russian history. The siege of St. Petersburg during World War II, then called Leningrad, you know, went on for a couple of years. And, you know, so Russia knows all about that kind of privation. They are inflicting that now in Ukraine. And we're seeing this as a specific strategy. 2.5 million refugees now have already left the country. Kiev started a war 2 weeks ago with a population of 2.9 million. It's estimated now there's only about 2 million people left in Kiev. It's just an incredible, forced migration. And as I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about the pandemic, you know, it's the kind of situation that just lends itself to spread of a highly transmissible virus. So, you know, there's just problems compounding upon problems upon problems with all this. But it does look like, Putin is doubling down on this war. It's going to have a global economic impact. It's already starting to have a global economic impact with oil prices. It's served to isolate Russia. And, you're starting to see, more Russian disinformation being parroted on the far right in this country. I want to talk for a little bit about the, conspiracy theory du jour on the right, which is that Russia was justified in invading Ukraine because the United States was operating secret bioweapons laboratories in Ukraine. This is kind of nonsense. It's built upon a kernel of truth, which is that the United States has been involved in basically safety protocols for existing bioweapons labs that dated to the Soviet era that were decommissioned in Ukraine. This is not secret at all. There's been congressional testimony on this over the years, etc. But you had Donald Trump stating that this was a fact, you know, the Kremlin talking point this week, and then Tucker Carlson has picked it up the last couple nights. So it's fast becoming an article of faith among the credulous right that the United States is operating secret bioweapons labs in Ukraine is absolutely categorically not true. But, you know, some people will believe anything.
They clearly, the U.S. does have bioweapons labs here in the U.S., not far from Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So, all right.
Yeah, there's a reason they were the go-to expertise for the Ukrainians.
Yeah, rich history of that, which we can cover on other shows. But anything else you want to touch on that, or we only got a few minutes left?
We got a couple minutes left, right?
Yes, yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about climate change and some...
Okay, more good news.
Yes, we cover the apocalypse in real times here. The sea ice around Antarctica has reached a record low in four decades of observation. Of course, it's summer in the Southern Hemisphere right now. And similar to sea ice in the Arctic, which we've seen has been melting for some time, it's been melting in the ice shelves around Antarctica as well. And that is by far the biggest source of ice and the biggest source of rising sea levels in the world. It's even more than the melting ice cap in Greenland. That's very much not good news. And then there was a significant IPCC, which is a UN agency that tracks climate change, IPCC report last week that the dangers of climate change are mounting so rapidly that they can soon overwhelm the ability of both nature and humanity to adapt. I don't know how many alarm bells they need to ring about this, but that of course got buried by Ukraine news, not surprisingly enough. The IPCC reports have been getting buried by pandemic news, but I guess at least there was something new to ignore that in favor of. But this is becoming an existential crisis for humanity, and it's something that really needs to be front page news every day, honestly, until, you know, humanity is moving away from fossil fuels and taking some of the other essential steps to try and save ourselves, because that really is what's at stake. And the IPCC report last week underscored that. So I did want to take a minute to encourage people to go find that and read it for yourself, and then, you know, start advocating for meaningful the kind of political impetus that's going to be necessary to really fundamentally redesign our economy so that we can survive.
Yeah, and if, you know, people got any extra time beyond addressing our climate catastrophe that is just knocking on the door, we also want to remind people that we have the Bangor Trident Nuclear Sub Base is just 20 miles from Seattle and is the largest repository of nuclear weapons in the Western Hemisphere. And it might be a good time to address impending nuclear war by perhaps considering
maybe
taking apart our nuclear weapon system here.
Yeah, because that is a very local story.
It is. And they're having weekly vigils, I know, on Fridays at the gates of the Trident Sub-Base.
As they have for years and years and years, yeah.
Yeah, but they're stepping it up now. And so the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, we both have many friends that are there. You can find out more about them at their website, gzcenter.org.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, it's a good time to start talking about nuclear weapons again and nuclear power.
Well, with that, sir, we are pretty much out of time, I believe, for this week. So climate and war permitting, we'll have to do this again next week.
Yes, let's hope we're all here to do it.